Hello, my name is Dr. Jim Doty, and I'm the host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast, where we explore the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. Hi, this is Dr. Jim Doty, host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast. My guest today is Chad Ming Tan. Many of you know him from his work as a software engineer at Google, where he was called the Jolly Good Fellow, which nobody can deny. He's written an international bestseller called Search Inside Yourself, based on a program on mindfulness, which he developed while at Google. He's a movie producer, a philanthropist, the co-founder of Buddhism.net, and the co-chairman of 1 Billion Acts of Peace. He recently retired from Google and now promotes Buddhism throughout the world. I hope you enjoy our conversation today. Ming, welcome to my podcast. Thanks so much for coming on. Obviously, we've known each other for many years, and actually, one of the first things I want to acknowledge is your amazing support of CCARE, the center I run at Stanford, and the extraordinary gift you gave, and also just your support in general. And it's been wonderful to see what you've continued to do in the world. There are probably a few people who don't know you. And one of the things I like to do is to begin with people to ask them a little bit about their backgrounds. And of course, I know you're from Singapore, but tell me how a Singaporean ended up at Google.
My background is Batman. Besides that, background. So I grew up in Singapore, and I was a smart kid. So I taught myself to program a computer at 12. And back then, in the 80s, that was a big deal. And then I taught myself to program in assembly language at 13. So that means that I was programming the CPU itself, which is a big deal even today, like for a 13-year-old kid. And then when I was 15, I won my first national award in programming. I was 17, I won my first championship. Yeah, so glory days. And then I lived through the normal Singaporean life. You know, I served in the army, I got a job, and then I went to university, and then I decided to go to graduate school, and I went to UC Santa Barbara. That's the University of California in Santa Barbara. The joke is that I went there for the beach, and I didn't mind the graduate degree. So I went there, and then there was a higher dot-com boom, right? And and then Silicon Valley was booming, and I could get any job I wanted. And so I interviewed with this company called Google. And if you don't mind me telling a story, what happened was, like I said, dot-com boom, we can get a job. I can get any job I wanted. We had a joke. The joke was, my friend was telling me, if you send out your resume, you can get a response within 5 minutes. And we all laughed. So I was at a computer, I pressed send, and anyway, I timed it. And literally within 5 minutes, I got a response. It was that hot back then, the job market. So I got a call from Google on a Tuesday. And I told them, look, I'm off the market by Friday. If you want me, get me in now. And so they scrambled to get me an on-site interview, which was on a Thursday. Right? And then Thursday I went in for the interview. It was a full-day interview. And halfway during that, there was lunch. And the person who took me out for lunch was this woman called Marissa. And she later on became very famous because later on she became the CEO of Yahoo. So we were at lunch together. And then she accidentally let slip. She said, we've already decided whether or not to hire you. And I said, okay, that's either very good or very bad. So next day on Friday, I got my job offer. And I accepted it on the spot. So that was how I ended up in Google. And the reason I chose Google was because it has the toughest interview. Like I have a principle, which is I don't want to be the smartest person in a room. because if I'm the smartest person in the room, I don't learn anything. And so I want to work with people who are smarter than me. And the interview was tough. And I figured whoever survived that interview had to be smart. And I want to work with them so I can learn from them. So that was how a Singaporean ended up in Google.
Now, that's fascinating. And I think Google continues to have challenging interviews for smart people. But how did you go from sort of that initial engineering position to become the Google Jolly Good Fellow and the creation of Ming's Wall? And I think many people may not realize it, but there was literally at one time, it may still be there, something called Ming's Wall, which shows you with the various and sundry famous people, celebrities who have visited Google during the time you were there, and they created an entire wall. And if I recall correctly, I thought I actually saw an article in the New York Times about you and that wall.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so about the Jolly Good Fellow title, yeah, I think it's the coolest title in the world, right? And the way I got the title was, again, it started as a joke. A lot of things that I do started as a joke, right? So I joined Google, it was a startup. And when you join a startup, you don't really have a job title. And then eventually, we started becoming a real company. A real company has structure. It has a career ladder. So engineers make fun of that, right? And then the highest rank on the career, on the engineering career ladder is the Google Fellow. And I made a joke. I say, why be a Google Fellow when you can be a Jolly Good Fellow? Right? I say that, everybody laughed. And one of my philosophies is, if everybody laughs, that is the right thing to do. So I just sent it in for printing, right? So on the Google website, you can just get your own business card printed, key your own job title. So I put Jolly Good Fellow with parentheses, which nobody can deny. That's a joke. Everybody around me are laughing. And the reason I put which nobody can deny is because before it gets printed, it has to be approved by HR. And I knew HR will reject it. They will deny it. So I already said, well, nobody can deny. So I have a funny story to tell either way. And then it turns out that HR had a sense of humor. They approved it, to my surprise. I got back my business card and it says Jolly Good Fellow, which nobody can deny. And so I started giving them away. And then it just became a thing. And then it ended on the front page of the New York Times. And then I got stuck with it. So the story of Ming's Wall, you're right. So it was on the front page of the New York Times. And so it started again. It wasn't a joke, but more like it's funny. Right? So Al Gore visited Google a long time ago, right after the election. And then I asked for a picture of him because, you know, I need to impress my mom. For those of you who are Asians, you get it. For those who are not Asians, yeah. Asian moms are not easy to impress. So, and if there's no picture, it didn't happen. So I asked for a picture with Al Gore. And then I took the picture. And then a few months later, I was in my office minding my own business. I looked out of my office window and I saw police cars surrounding the Google campus. So back then, Google campus is one small building with a car park around it. That's the Google campus. And I was like, whoa, there's a stakeout or something. Something's happening, right? So I walked inside the building looking for like what's happening. And I saw like big men with dark wave suits, dark glasses, and earpieces. Somebody important in the building. And of course, I asked them who they wouldn't talk. So what did I do? I just sat at the lobby waiting for somebody important to show up. And then it was President and Mrs. Carter.
Wow.
So I asked for their picture. And so I put those pictures on outside my office. And then it became a thing, right? So anybody who's famous to come by, they have to have the picture added to their wall. And it became so big that eventually I had to move it out and put it at the lobby, at the Google lobby. So and then you got a front page of New York Times. So it was at the lobby, New York Times reporter walked past. He took a double take, right? And then he asked for an interview with me and through Google PR. Like PR person called me and say, well, if I say no, And then she was like, according to him, no, you will be like in the inner pages, like nobody's going to see it except your family. So it's fine. Okay, I'll do it. and then it was on the front page of the New York Times. And then, that's funny. There's another part of the story, which is the week after that, maybe 2 weeks after that, I met with this person running for president. He was a long shot at the time. And his name was Barack Obama. He wasn't going to win, but he visited us anyway. And so because he's kind of famous, I asked for a picture with him, right? And then he shook my hand and he was like, "You're the guy of the New York Times, aren't you?" So he said, "How do you know you're famous, right? When Barack Obama knows you from the New York Times." So that was the story.
Wow. So let's shift gears a little bit, though. And let me ask you, because the mindfulness course that you began at Google, Search Inside Yourself. So maybe you can share with us why you got into meditation and then how that resulted in the creation of Search Inside Yourself and also how that has evolved.
So it started with pain. I think people of my generation, I think including you, brother, which we all come to meditation because of pain. And because back then, meditation was not cool. And you had to be desperate to try it. And I was desperate. I was in so much pain, I was suicidal in my youth. This was the last resort. And it worked.
So maybe you can just tell us, though, what was the cause of your pain that you could not deal with?
I think that in retrospect, I was suffering from chronic depression, probably clinical. Right. So I was always very unhappy. And as you heard from my story just now, I was very accomplished, right? I was like one of the best in the country when it comes to computing at the age of 13 or something. Yeah, and I was still very unhappy. And so out of desperation, I learned meditation. And if you don't mind me telling a story a little bit, and you can edit it out later. So I was literally the worst meditator on earth. I mean, literally. And I know that because I couldn't breathe. I mean, like, who is stupid enough to not know how to breathe? This guy. So when I started learning meditation, I was like, this is so hard. And so
now, who was your teacher at the time?
I had a variety of teachers because I was in Singapore. I went to those Buddhist centers, and then whichever monk was there, right, was the instructor of the day.
How old were you then?
Like 20-ish. I was about 21. I was 21. Yeah. So that was after I decided to become a Buddhist and learn meditation. And eventually I found a good teacher, Mr. Godwin. So this was about around that time. I couldn't breathe, and so what did I do, right? The obvious thing, I tried harder. Because I tried harder, even harder. And so one day I decided to just give up. I can't do this. This is too hard. But I already made a commitment to do this. So the way I gave up was I just sat at the chair, at the massage cushion, and just did nothing. So I just sat there doing nothing, and I caught myself breathing. I said, whoa, that was my first real meditation. Caught myself breathing. I could breathe. I could meditate. And then during the same sit, I had this experience of joy coming from inside of me, feeling my entire body and mind. Like just joy, immense, immersive joy. And it lasted for about 30 minutes. And that was life-changing. And then after that, it went away. And a few months later, it came back, and it went away. It came back, and then the time it came back keeps getting shorter and shorter. I mean, the time in between. And eventually, it became a skill. Something I can do on demand. And then my depression went away. Changed my life. Right? And so I went from, You know me when I was in Google. By then, I was a jolly good fellow. You probably know me as the guy who's always laughing and always smiling. That was not me before. right? It's like a total 180 degrees transformation. I became a different person. And so, and then when I was in Google, I benefited so much. I want to give this to the world. I want to share this and teach people how to do this. And one day I was taking a walk around the Google campus. Back then again, that was a small building, 2003, summer, August. And I had that moment where I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, right? Which is to create the conditions for world peace in my lifetime. And to do that by scaling inner peace, inner joy, and compassion worldwide. And to do that by helping people succeed in life and at work with inner peace, inner joy, and compassion. And to do that with meditation, mindfulness. What I thought that changed my life, I would teach that, help people succeed, and they'll become happier, and they become peaceful, and they become compassionate. And then we have we will have a happy world. We have a world where everybody's happy and it's a good world.
Well, so, you know, I was just going to say, it's interesting, though, how, you know, so many people focus on themselves. And in fact, in some ways, that's a cause of depression because it ends up being all about you.
Yes.
And then you have the negative self-talk that all of us have.
Yes.
And only when you can look through the lens to be of service to others, actually, to get all the benefits, I think, of being compassionate and being mindful.
Yes. And it actually works both ways. So I say inner peace, inner joy, compassion. There's a linear relationship, right? I found that when I'm at peace, the joy arises, right? So peace leads to joy. And then when you're joyful, I found that what happens, it helps a lot in compassion. Because you're happy in yourself, you want to be of service to other people, right? So it's this linear relationship. And the reverse is also true, as you just alluded, which is if you started with compassion, wanting to serve, then you become happier. And the happiness is the type of happiness that is not based on selfishness. Like it's a very encompassing, embracing kind of happiness, joy, and therefore it is peaceful. And therefore, the reverse, compassion leads to inner joy, which leads to inner peace. And then so this, the training, the Buddhist training, the Buddha tell you to do all three, and it's that because they have this relationship. So that was what I did. So I had this moment of clarity. This is what I'm trying to do with the rest of my life. And so that's what led me to create Search Inside Yourself, right? Which is a curriculum to help people succeed at work and succeed in general with peace, joy, compassion being the unavoidable side effects. And then I did that, and it became the most popular class in Google. Like people were like, classes will get filled up in 30 seconds. Not 30 minutes, 30 seconds. And people were angry at me. And then because of that, I need to expand the classes. And so I started writing down what I say in class in detail, like word for word. And as I was doing that, I realized I was writing a book. So I just turned it into a book project. And I asked my boss, Karen, you know her, I asked Karen for 3 months off, 13 weeks to 13 weeks of unpaid leave to write the work, to write the book. And Karen, as you know, she's very, very kind. With that compassion, she asked, you know, can you realistically write a whole book in 13 weeks? And I said, I don't know, but I know one way to find out. So she gave me the 13 weeks off. And turns out Karen was right. I couldn't write a book in 13 weeks. It took me 14 weeks. And whose fault was it? It was the Dalai Lama's fault. Why? Because that 1 week was in Stanford. So we were there with him the entire time. So therefore, I couldn't write my book.
So it's my fault now. It's also
your fault. Yes. Yes. I figured that, and I always try to blame the Dalai Lama for something.
Well, I have to say, though, that was really a joyful and profound experience being with His Holiness during that period of time. And it was such an honor for me to be able to invite him. And, of course, actually, without your support of Seek Care, it would not exist. And I know you and I together actually met him up in Seattle. Wow, was that in 2007, I think it was?
Something, yeah. No, right. Yes. We are that old. Yes. For those of you watching this, yeah, we are old men.
Yes, yes. Getting older all the time. Actually, let me just tell a funny side story, because when you and I met, every time we met, and we were introduced actually by Tenzin Tethong, who was the former head of the Tibetan government in exile, and actually had a role at Stanford in the Tibetan Studies program. But he and I became friends. He subsequently introduced you to me. And what's funny is every time we would meet, there would always be this sort of tall, skinny, gangly kid with you. And of course, that ended up being Joel Finkelstein, who, you know, I assume since he was with you, he was an engineer. And what's so funny about that is that as I was sort of trying to plan the center that was going to become CCARE at Stanford, I ended up talking both to you and Joel was very enthusiastic. And I said to him, I said, wow, it would be great, you know, if you'd consider maybe helping me over at Stanford. You go, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. I'd love to help in any way I could. And what I didn't realize, of course, though, was that he was a massage therapist at Google.
That's right. Yes. And now he has a PhD from Princeton.
Yes, yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and that trajectory for him was actually quite profound. And again, another side note, I was just with him recently in New Jersey, and he's there, and he started his own entity. But anyway, enough about Joel. I'm sure he remains quite appreciative of actually the opportunities you gave him, and which allowed him to really become who he is today. So, and obviously he helped me a lot, and I supported him as well. But in some ways that epitomizes what we're talking about. You know, when you're there and present for others and have this joy and peace about yourself, then extraordinary things can happen. And it's such a joy to see when that occurs. So when did you sort of formally become a Buddhist, if you will?
It was a few days before I turned 21. And what happened was, so I was depressed, I was suicidal, and I tried everything, nothing worked. And so I tried science, I tried philosophy, right? I mean, nothing worked. I tried religion. I learned Zen, I tried to learn Zen Buddhism. It's like, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, effort is a non-effort. I don't get it. I mean, now I got it. Now I consider myself like Zen is my was my root, but I didn't get it at the time, right? And then I went to church. I mean, I went to Catholic school, so I thought I knew everything about church. But the church I was invited to was a charismatic church. And back then it was a new concept to me. It was Pentecostal, and I saw people I saw people crying. Like speaking in tongue, and I was like, "Whoa!" I figured it out. I figured out religion. Right, these people, they come to church once a week. They relieve all their pain for the week. They go out there and get and suffer. Next week, they're here to relieve pain. I figured it all out. This is amazing. I can do this. Right. And then by coincidence, I met a Buddhist nun, I think the same week. Yeah, it was a couple of days later. I think it was a Tuesday or something. So that was Sunday and it was Tuesday. I told Venom, remember Sangye Kadu? She's a nun from the Tibetan tradition, but she was an American, white American woman from LA. So I went to her. I said, Venerable, I just went to a church last week. Right. And I saw for myself how they deal with suffering. And so I asked her, what do you have in your Buddhism that deals with suffering? And she said, all of Buddhism is about dealing with suffering. And I had, wow, back that moment. And the way I described it was that like the floodgates open, and then like a million tons of water just came brushing through. And the do what I told myself was everything made sense. So everything in my life made sense. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew I was this close. And then the week after that, I saw the same nun. And this time she was speaking at my university. And I attended her lecture. And in the middle of the lecture, she said one sentence. She said, "It is all about cultivating the mind." And I had my sudden moment. I got it. And I told myself, from this moment on, right here, right now, I'm a Buddhist. And from now on, I'm going to learn meditation. And I never looked back. And that was the moment.
Let me ask you a question, though. You know, obviously, with the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn and others, who, if you will, their goal was to bring Dharma to the West, but in the context of a program for alleviating actually physical pain. Two aspects of this. One is that some people have argued that that form of mindfulness leaves out the explicit aspect of compassion for self and compassion for others. And having talked to John, he admits that, but he says that it is an implicit part of a mindfulness practice. What we've done at SeeCare is create a program that is a bit more explicit about that. But we've seen the proliferation associated with innumerable articles that demonstrate the benefit of mindfulness type of practice. But some people have argued that everybody and their brother now, quote unquote, teaches mindfulness, and that it, in fact, Ron Purser has used the term "mic mindfulness." What are your thoughts on that?
Mindfulness is one of the I think mindfulness is the pillar of the Buddha's system that the system taught by the Buddha, and I think he was quoted as saying something like, there's one thing that leads to all things good, up to nirvana, and that one thing is mindfulness of the body. Not just mindfulness, specifically mindfulness of the body, right? What Jon Kabat-Zinn actually teaches. And so maybe I'll tell a story, a slightly long story,
sure.
And you can edit this out. And this was a study. I'm sure you're familiar with this study. The study was... The question behind the study was, if we teach people mindfulness versus if we teach people compassion training, how would that affect the compassionate behavior? Right, that was a research question, and the way the experiment was set up was, one third of people were randomly selected to do mindfulness class for like 8 weeks or something, one third for compassion class. And then one third control group, I think yoga or something. And then they were told at the end of it, they were told to go into the clinic to do some tests and paperwork or something. But what they didn't know was that the experiment was in the clinic, right? So they went to the clinic waiting room. And so everybody there is an actor. Right? So they went to the clinic waiting room, and what they would see like a couple of chairs, right? And so all the chairs are occupied except one. And so the subject will register, and then you're told, "Can you please wait, take a seat and wait?" So he sits and wait. And then after that, somebody walks in crutches, looking in pain. So again, he's an actor, like a pain. And then none of the other people stood up for him. So it creates a social context, right? So the question, what is the probability that this person will stand up for him? So in the control case, is about one third, about 33%. 33% probability they will stand up for this person. Then the question, what about mindfulness case? Mindfulness, so maybe compassion. What about if you do compassion training just before you enter the room? It doubled it to about 67%. Right? Amazing. It doubles. And the question now, what about mindfulness only? No compassion. Answer, also about 67%. Same as a mindfulness case. Right? To some people, that might be mind-blowing. But for somebody who practices mindfulness, it doesn't make... I mean, it's not surprising. The reason is not surprising. It's because a large part of compassion comes from awareness. Awareness that people are suffering. And that is related to the awareness that I'm suffering. Right? So if you already have the awareness that most of your compassion is already there, right? So the person walked in, you have awareness, this person is suffering. Here, I mean, instinctively, you say, hey, I'm a chef. You don't even think about it. And that comes from mindfulness alone. So that's one thing. The other part of it is, remember I talked about this, inner peace, inner joy, compassion. And mindfulness, it's very strongly associated with at least the first piece, right? When you're mindful of the body and then your mind calms down, then you enjoy this delicious peacefulness. And from there, the joy arises. And then because of that, you have low capacity to give. And then at the same time, because of mindfulness training, you have awareness of people suffering, you naturally want to give. So the compassion, if you practice mindfulness correctly, the compassion comes naturally. So in that sense, it's implicit, but in a sense, it's natural. It's just a whole flow, it's a system. So for those who say that mindfulness practice alone doesn't lead to compassion, my suspicion is they themselves are not practitioners. So they're seeing it from a theoretical point of view. The amount of benefit you get is proportional to the amount of practice you put in, right? So the analogy is like going to a gym, right? If assume you have a good teacher, right? Someone who's an Olympic gold medalist, right? Then wow, I mean, and then assuming that you have the reverse, you're some guy who kind of know how to do this, and that's your teacher. Oh, and you go to the gym. Well, you get the same benefit? Roughly the same benefit. Right? What you get out of it is comes from what you do, not who the teacher is. The teacher is helpful, especially if you go like deep in. For example, if you're training to be an Olympian, then the first teacher is really helpful. Because among other things, one of the key things is the first teachers know about training injuries. That is huge. Right? And he also knows the optimal training methods and so on, so blah, blah, blah. However, if you're just starting out from scratch, all you want to do is just work out. Yeah. Doesn't make much difference. Like the gym teacher you have, I mean, if you go to the gym teacher, my guess is probably not an Olympian. But it doesn't matter. So similarly here, I think if you're doing like the popularization of practice, I think if people just want to be a little bit more like having more awareness of themselves, you know, not the calmer, they deal with stress better, if that's their goal, I think we should meet them where they are. We should not like expect them to be compassionate, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, and that level, I think the simple instructions that everybody give, I think is sufficient. And for those who want to go deeper, they just keep practicing for like, I don't know, many, many hours, they will naturally become more compassionate. And for those, I agree, having a good qualified teacher, it really helps.
But as you know, there are many people who say, gosh, I've tried mindfulness a million times and I can't relax, and the negative thoughts still I turn to or respond to. Now, certainly I'm a fan of Thich Nhat Hanh, who, of course, you know or knew as well. And he talks about sort of talking meditation or walking meditation. And also there's this philosophy in the Japanese society about forest walking. Maybe you can comment on that and the problem sometimes with people. In fact, it's people who often are high achievers who have difficulty because they so want to do it correctly.
Right. Maybe first thing is that, so the first principle, why are we doing all this practice? Right. I go straight to the punchline. The punchline is everything we're doing is learning to let go. All that hard training, all that thousands of hours sitting is to learn to let go. And the more you practice, the more you can let go. So the consequence of what I just said is that the reason practice is so hard at the beginning, and my own experience, not really, because I haven't learned that lesson, which is about letting go. Even letting go just a tiny bit, whatever tiny bit you can let go of, it helps a lot. So for example, the thoughts that arises in our mind. Again, I go to the punchline and I come to where we are. The punchline is that if you sit long enough, the mind naturally settles itself. Right? You don't have to do anything. Right? It goes from a raging waterfall, I mean the thoughts. So what do you wrote? Well, from a raging waterfall to a fast river to a slow stream, and then later on it's to calm as lake. Right? And the process of doing that is just letting go. So if you know that, right? If you know that, and then if at the beginning you're like raging waterfall, what did you do? One thing you could do is just allow you to rage. The other thing you could do is, damn it. This sucks. I suck. Right? So these two different approaches, the first one will work because the first one naturally allows that natural process of letting go until it comes down. The second is by not knowing that, not understanding the process, resisting, then you will have that difficulty. Therefore, what the Buddha did was, again, the Buddha was the genius. Right? He says that there are actually four postures you can do your meditation on. Sitting is only one posture. The other three postures are walking, standing, and lying down. So, and in traditional monasteries, and I think maybe even during the Buddha's time, they alternate between sitting and alternate between these postures, but specifically sitting and then and walking. And the reason you want to do that, part of it is because it gets your blood flowing. Another part of it is precisely what you just said, Jim, which is that if you're the type of person who get bothered by a raging waterfall when you're sitting there watching it, then when you're walking, you are doing something. Like the certain part of mind is like observing the doing. And because it's doing, that raging waterfall doesn't like rage so much. And then it helps. Right. So I definitely agree with you, and I recommend for those who are listening, remember those four postures. If one of the postures doesn't help, try the other three. My guess is at any one time, one of those four will help. For example, for me, I got back pain a lot. And so I do a lot of my meditation lying down. And it's actually a valid posture. It's not a joke.
Well, no, I think that's right. I think this is where what some people forget is they have a perception of what quote unquote meditation is or mindfulness, and it has to be on a mat with your legs crossed in a certain position, and then they say, well, I couldn't do it there, therefore it's not going to help me. But again, as you said, you have to be persistent, you have to show up, and you have to do the work. Let me ask you, obviously we talked about Search Inside Yourself, the book, which was extraordinarily popular. And then you wrote another book called Joy on Demand. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, unless something's happened in between, you've written a book called Buddhism for All.
Yes, I did.
And maybe you could tell us...
I'm doing a very no wiping.
Yeah. Maybe you can tell us how that is additive to your two other books. And what are the key points or lessons within that book that maybe pull it all together?
Mm-hmm. So Search Inside Yourself was about how to practice mindfulness in the way that helps you succeed in life and also help you become have inner peace, inner joy, compassion. So that's why it's so popular, and partly because people want to be successful, they don't mind being happy. And then the second book was, given what I just said, I mean, I say it as a joke, but I actually think happiness is important. So the second book was a deep dive on the one subject of happiness, right? And the third book is a deeper dive, and it's a source code, right? So for those of you who, and for those who like are really into this stuff, you if you have an application that you use a lot, and then you can do magic with it. And then at some point, you find that your magic is limited by how much you can change the tool, how much you can understand it. If you had the source code, you will be the wizard. Okay. And then such as, yeah. And this is the source code, right? Where everything I taught in Searching Inside Yourself and Joy and Demand came from. So in a sense, wonderful. That's how they're related. Yeah.
Now, one of the things you mentioned a couple times is the word peace. But you've been involved with the 1 Billion Acts of Kindness program.
Peace. 1 Billion Acts of Peace.
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry. There is a 1 Billion Acts of Kindness, which actually I was involved with.
That's
which
right.
Is a different
yes, that was
thing.
You.
But anyway. 1 Billion Acts of Peace. Tell me what that is exactly. And as I understand it, it's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize multiple times.
So it started with an organization called Peace Gem. Right? And again, I tell you a bit of story, and you can edit this out. Iran was living in a not so nice neighborhood, right? And the kids were like misbehaving, and he asked them who would you listen to, and they was like, I will listen to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, right? So he had this idea of bringing Nobel Peace Prize winners and young people, I mean what we call kids, young people. Then they can make magic with each other. And so what he did was he called Father Tutu. There was like in the 80s or something, right? So we had these huge phone books. He got a phone book of South Africa and he called Father Tutu. And Father Tutu, somehow he managed to get to talk to either Father Tutu or his staff. And Father Tutu was like, I would do this if you can get my best friend involved, and who is the Dalai Lama, right? So Iman called the Dalai Lama, and so His Holiness invited him to go to Dharamsala, and Iman didn't have any money, so he asked. He said he's a couple of dollars in his bank account, so he asked all his friends for money to get a trip to see the Dalai Lama. So, and he made it happen. So eventually, it was an organization with like 13 Nobel Peace Prize winners who are on the board. They're the only ones on the board. The board is only Nobel laureates, and they interact with kids, right? And then Father Tutu gave them a challenge. He was like, we shouldn't just be talking. We should be taking actions. And we should have and Father Tutu challenged them to create 1 billion acts of peace. Like 1 billion, which seems like an impossible number. So at about that time, they came to ask me for advice. And the name of the campaign was a Global Call to Action. And I said, that is a horrible name. You should rename it 1 billion acts of peace. And they were like, no, the Nobel, 14 Nobel laureates came out with this name. I was like, go back to them, tell them to change it. So they had a board meeting, and they approved it. So they changed it to 1 billion acts of peace. And then they asked me for other advice on other things, and I just kept giving them advice. And then eventually, they were like, can you help us to do this? And so I helped them start doing stuff. And then eventually, they were presenting this at the UN. And they were like, hey, it's going to be at a General Assembly area, right? That location. Not just any part of the UN, the General Assembly. Would you like to represent us? I said, okay, for that I'll go. So I go to speak at the UN in that room and presenting 1 billion acts of peace. And I was just get sucked in, a little bit at a time. I just give them random advice, and eventually I became co-chair.
Wow.
And then we went from, during that time, we went from 2 million to about 17 million acts of peace. And the way I say it at the time is, it's a story of my life because I'm 93% failure. 7% success. And so about that time, Father Tutu, he saw our work and he nominated us for the Nobel Peace Prize. And then he asked six of his friends who were Nobel laureates to also nominate us. So that's how we got seven, the first seven nomination. And then later on, our one other joined and then we had eight. So that's how it happened. And then once you have eight Nobel Prize nominations, I couldn't leave the position anymore. Because I owe it to Father Tutu. You know?
Yes, he Tutu was an amazing man. I had the pleasure of getting to know him fairly well over the years. And in fact, I was responsible actually for the Book of Joy, which has been very popular.
Thank you.
Tell me, quote unquote, you're retired. So what does retirement mean to you and what are the projects you're working on? I'm sure our listeners would love to hear what the next thing we're going to hear from Ming about changing the world. So share with us.
Basically, it's in a sense, it's very simple for me because I made a vow to dedicate the rest of my life in service to Buddha and Dharma. So whatever I do is just that service to Buddha and Dharma. The only question is how. And the way I chose to serve right now is to make the teachings of the Buddha understandable to everybody. Yes. I think a lot of people are interested, but they find it like incomprehensible. Especially if you start from the one of the more esoteric schools, but the form is form is emptiness is form. But what? So I chose to start with early Buddhism because early Buddhism is surprisingly understandable and powerful. I mean, those are things that the Buddha taught himself before the value add, that other masters that made it harder to understand. So that's strata. So I spent 5 years writing that book, Buddhism for All, and the reason it took so long is because I resolved to read the entirety of the early Buddhist canon. But all of it. Thousands of sutras. And in order to do justice, to write a book about early Buddhism, I should know all the early Buddhist canon. So I did that. And then I hope I succeeded in the book in making this understandable to everybody. So that's one. And in addition to that, I know the people who don't want to spend money or they cannot spend money. I'm putting out the book, Buddhism for All, on the web. So it's at buddhism.net. And we put in one section every three sections a week. So I think in a few months, we should finish posting the entire book. So for those of you who cannot afford a book, or don't want to pay for whatever reason, feel free to go to buddhism.net and you can get it for free. And then in addition to that, so that's the first thing, that the foundation, the knowledge, people understand it. They make it understandable, accessible, practical. People really say, I get it. I know how it's going to change my life. That's my goal. But there's more. The part that is more is practice. And so in addition to that, right, I want to create a directory of Buddhist centers and communities so they can all join communities. I mean, the Buddha was very clear about this. He says the most important thing that will lead somebody to practice is noble friends, noble friendship. Like friends, people like you, brother. People like you, when they look at you, it encourages me to practice. And so having a circle of friends like this, that's important. And I want to help everybody do that. Right. So that is it, and it works. Also, the practice part, Joy on Demand, I want to turn it into some sort of a curriculum online or something. I don't really know how to do that yet. And yeah, I think it's going to take me many, many years to do all this. And my goal is, in Buddhism, there are like four stages of enlightenment. The first stage is called stream entry. This is the stage where you see Nirvana. You're not there yet, but you see it clearly. And my hope is that by the time I die, 1 million people in this world reach the first stage of enlightenment. And then I can die. So I tell all my friends, if they ask me what they can do for me, I say, please help me to die. I can do that, then I can die. So that's my retirement, brother.
Well, I'm not sure if everybody's going to sign on to that today, I'm happy to assist you in regard to the positive aspects of that statement.
Okay, okay.
Well, listen, Ming, it was great catching up a little bit and seeing you again and hearing about the work you've done doing.
I'm going to do better than again.
Yes, yes. Everyone, go buy Ming's books, Search Inside Yourself, Joy on Demand, and Buddhism for All. Enjoy your retirement, my friend, and obviously we will remain in touch. So much love to you.
You too, brother.
Again, thank you for being with us today. The Into the Magic Shop podcast can be found where you find your most popular podcasts, or you can find us at intothemagicshop.com.